Now we have the stage of our evening where you make believe you have questions and I make believe I have answers. And I'll repeat the questions if you ask them, and just raise your hand and I'll call upon you when I can. And anything is fair game. Yes. This must be Madison, Wisconsin. What do I think of Dr. Kevorkian's work? I think that he is a symbol of a very profound ethical dilemma we're facing, which is whether individuals have freedom of consciousness in our society, whether they have the right to decide whether they want to live or die. And I think that's a very profound question. And I really am a very strong advocate of freedom of consciousness for the individual. And I think I'm very reticent for the state or the religion or anybody to take that over and take that away from people. I certainly feel we should be educated about the preciousness of human life, but I think people should have that choice. And I deal with so many people who are in incredible pain as they're approaching death and come to the place where they feel they've gone as far as they're able. Now, you could say, well, you can do better, or your soul can do better, or something. But I found that when people feel they have the choice of how much pain medication to take and when they've had enough, they are able to handle a lot of pain for a lot longer. But when they feel that they don't have control of that, their fear that the pain will get overwhelming and they won't be able to stop it starts to rule their life. So I am very sympathetic. I don't think I'd like to die in Dr. Kevorkian's trailer, but I understand what he represents, and I think the culture has to deal with that ethical issue. Am I dealing with your question? Yeah. Questions? What did I learn from Tim Leary's death, and what do I think he has to teach? Well, I was very close to Timothy during his dying period, and I learned a great deal because I went through a number of changes in my own consciousness about what was going on with Timothy. Timothy and I have disagreed for many years. We're very close friends, but we have disagreed as to whether one is dominantly focusing on form or emptiness. And I'm basically an empty Baba, and he's basically a form Baba. You could say he's a visionary and I'm a mystic, if you want to put it in kind of nice astral level terminology. Whatever it is, he was so committed to form that when he was approaching death, he was basically downloading the information onto his web page so that he would be eternal in virtual reality. Okay? And that's the obvious thing one would do if one were in his predicament. And then in case he couldn't get it all down, he had hired cryonics people to freeze his brain so that later, when technology developed a little bit, he could tune in again. And so I, as a psychologist, felt this was massive denial. And when everything began to hit the fan and his mind started to dissolve, he'd freak because this was all mind stuff from my point of view. And he knew I thought that way. And one of the great moments of those last days was he called me a few days before he died, and he said, Richard, he called me about 11:30 at night, he says, Richard, I think I'm losing my memory. And I said, yep. And he says, memory's almost everything. I said, yeah, see, that's just the way I thought he thought. And then he says, but you know, he said, there's something else besides that. I went, oh? And there was a silence. He says, but I forgot. That's a quality of humor that's very, very tasty. The last time I was with him, it was Faro. He was broke, and so he was always broke. So he was signing blotter acid sheets. And he's getting $100 a signature. He could hardly keep a. I mean, he was out there, you know, and he was still signing them. He couldn't quite remember how to write his name. And I was taking them away. I said, Timothy, we're doing peace work. You know, it was a great moment. But I looked into his eyes, and which we very rarely did, come to think of it, over all those years we were together. And he was so far back in there, behind all of the theater production of Dying, that I immediately, all my concern about denial dissolved. I saw that was the projection of my own mind. And that he was absolutely ready for the adventure. And I mean, I knew him as a fellow adventurer. And I met a person who was ready to adventure at the moment of death. And I thought that his the fact that he published his drug intake every day, and that was carried by CNN and Newsweek and places like that, I thought that was pretty interesting, because what he showed was that he was using medicines for three purposes. He was using it to relieve pain. He was using it to keep his consciousness alert. And he was using it to be happy and to have fun. And we don't push that in the culture. You're not supposed to have fun dying. It's out of the question. And he had a continuous salon, allowing many of us to be around him and share this journey with him. So I felt that he died in real style. I was very pleased with the way he died. Timothy, it's a complex life. I don't know that I could even begin to assess the life in terms of what contribution. For me, what he represented was that when I met him at Harvard, and we were both on the faculty there, he was the only one of the faculty that I knew that wasn't intimidated by being on the faculty at Harvard. If you can hear that, you know? That he had a freedom from these vertical institutions that scared the hell out of me. You can imagine why, because I had invested so much in this. But I saw that he was freeing me through his non-attachment, and that was very valuable to me. So I consider him my first spiritual teacher, and a very profound one. Yes. Has he helped me understand the mysteries he passed over? All I've got for you at this moment is that Marilyn Ferguson, who wrote a book called The Aquarian Conspiracy and some other books, she called me recently and she said, I've just had a message from Timothy. And I said, yes. And she said, I mean, I don't know where she's at, but that's what she's reporting. And she says, he said to tell you that you were right, only more so. That's a good thing. And then he said, tell Richard it's like Rome without the Vatican. I thought, that sounds like Timothy, you know? I mean, I don't know whether it's Marilyn's Meshuggah business or whether it's Timothy, but that's all I have to report about reports back from the front. Sir.
Feeling pain around me and seeing all the stuff. I was first
great question. Do you all hear it? Good. So I don't have to repeat it. Let me come at it a little just indirectly to deal with your question. When I started to see that I wasn't who I thought I was and started that journey, my first inclination was to push away where I had been because it was so painful to be so trapped in such a prison of my mind and to want to get high all the time, to get out there, to go somewhere else. And so I was very attracted to renunciate paths. And after some years of that, it was just my prediction, that my predicament, that that's the way my karma sent me. I realized at some point that as long as I was pushing away the world, I could never be free. That my aversion was my trap. That I was busy still feeling burned by the trap I had been caught in earlier. And I was ending up somebody who was not doing things. I was ending up a horny celibate, basically. If you can hear that juxtaposition. So I realized that what I had to do was turn my consciousness and come into life as a spiritual practice to see my way to be free, because I couldn't handle the aversion that I felt. When I turned my consciousness, which happened in about 74, in a really clear way, 73, 74, what I faced was the immensity of the suffering everywhere I looked, in myself and everybody else. Just immense amounts of suffering. And I immediately saw that staying open to that suffering was unbearable. And it took me a while to see that it was unbearable for everyone. And the choices were two. The choices were to push against it through denial. In other words, to try to change the world you live in so that you didn't have to be with that suffering somehow, live in a gated community or whatever. Because you look at television and you see violence and horror and suffering everywhere all the time. And how do you deal with this continuous amount of suffering of homeless people on the streets, of knowing the underclass is you know, alive and not so well around you, and it's part of your life? How do you deal with that? Most people somehow go numb. They just go in a way to protect themselves from this horror. It's not they don't see it, it's just that they have armored their hearts to protect their heart from breaking continuously over and over again, and they feel it is unbearable. That's one strategy to change what you see. The other strategy is to change who you are and to say, it is unbearable to who I think I am. Now, is there a part of my being to which this is not unbearable? And that's a very interesting question, because to you as a separate ego, what you see when you look at the suffering around you is unbearable. Now, I had this interesting situation. There was a moment when, in India, I had a Volkswagen microbus, and there was the opportunity to take my bus, I thought, to Bangladesh, where there was a terrible, terrible, terrible hardship. Many, many thousands of people were dying, to possibly use my Volkswagen as an ambulance. And I went to my guru. I was very agitated by what was going on in Bangladesh. And I went to ask him for his blessing to do this thing. And he didn't either say one way or the other. He was leaving that up to me, what I was doing. But he said to me, Ram Dass, don't you see it's all perfect? And when he said that, it felt like an obscenity. How could this man, who I knew to be so compassionate, say that this horrendous scene was perfect? I took that into myself and I kept working with it for years. And I came to see, as I kept deepening my own inner work, that there is a place from which you can look at the universe, in which you see the lawful nature of karma, the lawful nature of things unfolding. And when you see that includes suffering, it includes death, it includes loss, it includes all the qualities of human existence, birth and joy and all of it. It's all sort of an unfolding, just like when you watch the trees turn red leaves and fall off the trees, you get a sense that you're seeing the wonder of law unfolding. You're looking with awe at the mystery of the universe. And he was saying, you forgot that part of it. Don't you see it's also perfect? And what I realized was he was really saying also, he was saying, you've lost your balance. You're too caught in your humanity. You've lost the divinity. In the same way as if I was lost in the divinity, he would cry and say, don't you care about these people? What he was saying is, if you're going to bear the unbearable, you have got to be able to simultaneously live on more than one plane of consciousness at once. And you've got to be able to balance the pain of your heart, of the suffering, with the appreciation of the perfection of the mystery that you don't understand. And that balancing has changed my entire life experience. It does not mean that I can push away the pain in my heart. It means that the unbearable becomes bearable. It still means I do what I can to relieve the suffering, but I'm not being burned out by it. I'm not getting twisted by it, because I am not only the empathetic person for the suffering. I am also somebody who's playing in the mystery of the universe. Is that dealing with your question at all? Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. And I would agree with you that various practices work for a while and then they don't work after a while, which is what you said before. As Gurdjieff said, an alarm clock awakens you one moment, the next moment you sleep right through it. You know, and it's that way, see? So all I can say is, your understanding of the possibility and your intention to find that balance keeps leading you to look at the experiences of your life as a vehicles to regain that balance. Okay, that's really the way it works. Until you're using everything in your life all the time to regain that balance. And that balance is to see, to get the two planes going all the time. If you get caught in one, you come up into the other. If you get too caught in the soul and you forget the ego, psychophysical world, somebody falls down and you say, karma. See, there's no heart left in it. And it's just as bad that way as the other way. You got to get it all going all at once. So just don't be a slob. Get on with it. Yes. Will Chicago what? Will the Chicago Cubs ever win the pennant? Just a minute. They told me, but they asked me not to tell. Questions? Yes. What is my present view about use of chemicals to alter consciousness? And I assume you're asking about Prozac and caffeine and... I must tell you all, and I know this won't be totally popular with you, but that I am very pleased and did back in many, many ways Proposition 215 in California, which has passed. So, because I really feel there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy in this society around chemicals, and that that dialogue has to be had, that it is not fair to ask young people to make believe something's real that they see isn't real, and to treat adults as if they are wisdom people when they are acting in rather asinine ways about drugs. And it is clear to me that the prohibition is creating much of the problem that the society is facing about drugs, and that it has to be rethought through. And when Bill Clinton moves from being a political entity to being a wise entity, then something may change in that. And we just can pray for that process to happen and help it happen as much as we can. I think that that the drugs, that use of chemicals to change consciousness has become a major social issue in this society. And in certain segments of the society where crack is used, for example, inner cities, for example, places like that, it is used to escape from situations which are really very, very hard and very harsh. And rather than us dealing with the harshness of those situations, we are focusing on the escape vehicle. All right? In the middle class, the use of cocaine, for example, is used, in my estimation, by people who played the game and won at the game and then realized the game itself was not satisfying. That the myths of the society were not feeding the deepest qualities of the being. And after you won, it wasn't, you worked hard, you did it, and you won, and there's something more you want, and they're taking it for more. Which is a deep thing in our culture, that more is better. And enough is never enough. Which is a very interesting myth in the society that keeps externalizing our searching. So I think that we're seeing a symptom of a dysfunctional mythic structure, a dysfunctional structure in the society. And that if we are wise rather than expedient, and even expedience isn't working, if we're really wise, we will recognize that there are deeper causes and we'll start to work with those. And as far as psychedelics are concerned, or entheogens, as I'm happy to call them now, sounds more scientific, I think. What I think these do, and what they did for me, was show me a possibility that my consciousness was much more than I thought it was. And I experienced that, like my guru said to me, or said to us, when somebody said, should we use these things? He said, if you're feeling peace and your mind is turned towards God, and et cetera, cool place and thing, you could use it, it could be useful. Okay? Then he said at another time, it would allow you to come in and have the darshan of Christ, meaning you could come in and visit with the living spirit, is what he was saying to the Westerners in their terms. He said, but you can only stay 2 hours, then you got to leave again with your medicine. He said, it's better to become Christ than visit him, but your medicine won't do that. That's pretty interesting, because it shows that it allows you to see a possibility, but the thing that you yearn to do, which is to merge into the universe and stabilize in that way, and that method isn't useful. As far as using psychedelics in this society at this time, the predicament is that all of our research from the 60s on has shown very clearly that set and setting are critical determinants of the nature of the experience. That what the psychedelics do is override your learned habitual ways of processing information. And they allow you to see freshly. But that what you see is determined by what your preparation as an individual is, plus what support, what kind of a cultural setting you have. And when you're working with something like that in a cultural setting in which it is illegal and which there is this much paranoia about drugs, it is, you really got to carry a lot of inner stuff to be able to neutralize all that and realize you're not taking a whole paranoia when you take an when you ingest it. Okay. One more thing, since I'll give my whole shtick about this, more than you asked for, but about youth using psychedelics and age and so on. It feels to me that in my sequence of somebody special and then awakening to getting out of that, that you don't want to become nobody too soon until you've got your ground under you. And that there are agendas during the time when you have your sexual stuff to deal with, your environment, your economic stuff, your social stuff, the independence from family, all of this to deal with. That's probably not the optimum time to be experimenting with your consciousness, because there are a lot of seductive things that keep you in the world. It would be better to wait a while and do that later. There's my whole rap. I thought that was good. All of you.
Please flip the tape now and begin side B.